Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Autism Stories. I'm your host, Doug Bletcher, the founder of Autism Personal Coach. Autistic people are the true experts of the autistic experience, and Autism Stories is where we interview autistic people to learn from their stories, experiences, and get their insights. If you would like to be notified about each week's episode of Autism Stories, we suggest you subscribe on your favorite podcast listening platform. We would also appreciate it if you could give us a positive rating and review as you help others to learn about Autism Stories. On today's episode, Heather Myers joins us to discuss modern utopias, translating autistic experiences and demystifying them for a neurotypical audience, and her experience as a journalist. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. Heather, thanks so much for joining me here on Autism Stories.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Many of these episodes, I always want to start off by learning about your journey into the autistic community. Where does your story begin?
Yeah, it actually starts back in 2022. Suddenly, my oldest, as they were hitting adolescence and that like brain change, I just started noticing things, like they got so awkward, right? And they were this beautiful young child, like people would stop them on the streets and comment on their beauty. And so, you know, that hid a lot of their early autistic traits. They had sensory processing disorder from, you know, infancy, was recognized by the county, and social and performance anxiety in second grade. But, you know, people assigned female at birth, like, beauty gets you a long way in this society. So it wasn't until they got pimples and cut off all their hair for practical reasons, and that I could see the like, oh, you're awkward compared to society norms. And that is the only thing that kind of clued me in. And I started doing research on like subtle autism in girls and women, and that led to a neuropsych evaluation for my oldest, and that was confirmed. But they had like a more kind of, I know I don't use Asperger's, but like ASPE type profile, like more traditional, stereotypical ASPE kind of female profile. And I didn't, like, I'm such an extrovert, they're super shy, like we're opposites in every way. Like I love that child, but I'm like, you can't be extroverted and really good at social skills and, you know, like get society and be autistic, right? But in all that research, I saw all these tiny things that I'm like, oh, I do that. Like I do that, you know, on blogs by women with subtle autism. And I don't think subtle autism is really a separate thing either. It's all the same. It's just whether it's external or internal for me. So yeah, I was like, oh, I rub my feet to go to sleep. Is that weird? You know, like, and so I like basically diagnosed myself, but I was like, I have no idea why I'm autistic or how I'm autistic. So I did a neuropsych eval in February of last year, so like a year ago, and it confirmed. And then I was like shocked at like what the eval pulled out from my brain that I wasn't aware of doing. And so I've done all this research since, just for my kids' sakes. It turned out my spouse is also autistic and all my kids are, so it's been quite the journey.
Now, talking about beginnings, I saw on your website that there was a picture of you when you were 3 years old protesting the injustice of having to wear a shirt just because you're a girl, when all the boys could roam free in the heat of the summer. So I think that's really a great example of us as autistics not understanding society's expectations. Why do I have to do this thing? I was always asking questions as a child of like, why? So what societal expectations kind of present day would be helpful to change for you, and a result would very much improve your life?
So much, like everything. Like one, I always understood the expectations. I just rejected them. So like the norms, I got them and I understood their history too, but I was just like, look, we're a modern society. Like I'm like very prepubescent here as a 3-year-old, the 5-year-old, like I look the same underneath my shirt as the boys do. And that's what it was. It was like, we look the same under our clothes at this time with just shirts, right? I got that. And I'm like, oh, we're not in the Victorian era anymore. So like, why do I have to wear a shirt? And I think today, like more parents are okay with their girls, you know, that age running around the backyard without a shirt. But there's still a pretty big stigma. But I think gender is a thing that is so challenging for someone who's autistic or neurodivergent, especially as a woman, just because we're so underidentified, because we can't actually, it's so not socially acceptable to have autistic traits as a woman, because people associate those with masculine traits as well. Like, you know, sloppy appearance, right? Like I could have never gotten away with wearing sweats and had my hair sticking up, which is a stereotype of autistic boys, but like all boys can get away with that, right? And so autistic boys can too, but no girls can get away with that. So autistic girls can't either. Does that make sense? So like we're all having to bury it so much more because like the band of like acceptable female behavior is so narrow compared to men. You know, you have to be attractive but not too attractive. You can't be too assertive in a meeting at work. Yeah, you can't be into geeky stuff like Lord of the Rings or Star Trek or whatever. Like it's not okay. So I assign gender, you know, I just want to be accepted for like my talents in a neutral way. Like what's my work product? Whether I'm autistic or not, it goes with being autistic or being a woman. Like you shouldn't consider someone's autism in evaluating their work, right? Like maybe they need to wear noise canceling headphones and sunglasses in your building, but like, how's the work, right? So like, that's the thing is I think people really, we need to get to a point in society that we don't base our expectations on stereotypes that just aren't true.
Now, I had mentioned your website called Fantastically Human, where you provide an autistic counseling practice that seeks to translate autistic experiences and demystify them to a neurotypical audience. What are some of these most common autistic experiences that you think neurotypicals struggle to understand?
I think the primary one is something that, you know, I assumed neuronormativity of myself my whole life and of my children, because everyone else assumed that as well. And it wasn't true. And as soon as I learned that my child was autistic, and even when I figured out that I was autistic before I understood why, I was like, oh, I guess we're aliens now. Like, I guess, you know, like we're unfathomable inside, like. And it didn't make any sense, but that was what my, you know, very limited and poor understanding of autism was, is that, you know, you're shut off from the world and that you're, you know, who knows what's going on in that brain. And it's like, no, like we're thinking the same things, we're feeling the same things. And if you see differences, it's really in how that's externalized. Yeah. And we often, more often than not, have like exceptional abilities. Like it's not like we're melting down because the air conditioner, like we're too sensitive to the air conditioner. It's like our hearing is so good and so amplified, like animal like hearing, that air conditioner is equivalent to a jackhammer. Like I can hear a tiny mouse in the walls in a different room of my house, and you know, when I hear that, it's me and the cat and the dog all go whoop, like suddenly, you know, and nobody else notices. So it's like if you take a microphone that's set to that sensitivity, it's gonna give you some significant feedback. It's not gonna work. So like that's how I feel I want to translate to neuronormative people that like, it's not because we don't have emotional regulation, right? Like, it's because what you're seeing in an autistic meltdown or anything is like actual suffering. Like you have to trust the external state as being reflective of our internal state.
Now, you've mentioned neuronormativity. I'm wondering, for you and your family, like, have there been some, like, you know, at one point I thought I was neuronormative as well. So a lot of things have changed in my life, I think, in a positive way since then. So I'm wondering, for you and your family, how is life different? Are there some ways that life is better now?
Yeah, it's so much better now. Like, you can see this baby grand piano behind me. I didn't play piano my entire adult life because I thought I was bad at it. And I was classically trained and I was in this music group in high school. And I really wanted to sing and dance along with them, but like they didn't have a pianist. So I got stuck, you know, playing piano, but I wasn't that good at it. I'm not good at accuracy. I'm not good at like, it's more of a finger thing, right? Like I can't get my fingers to... It's too stressful, right? So I just like didn't play for 20 years. The day I got my, you know, diagnosis, I don't think you can diagnose autism. I think it's more you're identifying autism. So I don't really call it a diagnosis. But when I got the results and learned why I was autistic, I like in the meeting, it was a Zoom meeting with my evaluator. And I just was like, I'm going to go play piano right now and sing. And he was like totally on board with it. and I'd been composing music and it's just like, I didn't let myself because yeah, like I didn't want to seem like I thought I had a great voice. I don't like, it's just like, this is joy. Like I had sort of cut off access to joy based on other people's opinions or imagined opinions of me like being a show off or whatever. And I'm like, no, like this adds joy to my life. So that's one thing. And I'm like in singer-songwriter series now, like performing, you know, and it's, I just started playing again last year after like 20 years. Another thing that my parenting has really changed, right? Like I know now from my own internal state and learning about kind of, I'm really unlearning things, right? It's not, I'm not learning, I'm unlearning like the weird norms that we have of like, you know, we used to drag one of our kids kicking and screaming to school when they would refuse to go to school. And they have PDA, which was like formerly known as pathological demand avoidance, which is pretty derogatory. So it's now more like pervasive drive for autonomy, which makes more sense and is more descriptive. And so we were just like, no, you have to go to school. Like we're going to drag you to school. And because society requires that you go to school. And now it's just like, yeah, you can do that, but at what cost? Like, you can make your kid, like, I was, you know, super normal because I grew up in a military family, like, in a very WASPy, conservative, like, culture of, you know, rigid rules, rigid social norms. And you don't jump on someone's couch. You don't, you know, you look people in the eye at all times who are your superiors. And so like I couldn't deviate that because I couldn't, right? And so you can, you know, train them onto thick people who don't have like associated motor disconnects or challenges or communication challenges that are extreme, which I think are separate. Like autism is autism and everyone's autistic. And then some people also have these like really profound communication and motor challenges that are part of it, like how I have ADHD, and that's really common with autism too. But I feel like I'm going off in a different direction. But yeah, so I reject those old norms. You demand, you're like, oh, like the kid's melting down and they're suffering. Let's work on the suffering, right? Alleviating the suffering. And maybe it's just like the stress of getting out the door in the morning and we can go in a little bit late. It's such a rush. I understand. I'm taking a lot of steps back and my own anxiety has gone down. Like one kid of my my youngest was melting down shortly after I learned I was autistic about, you know, Magnetile, those little, those toys. They're like clear and then you can build structures with them. So they were playing with the Magnetiles and so frustrated because they were, you know, they're young and just couldn't figure out how to build something that wouldn't collapse. And so what I did was I was like, oh, you're misunderstanding the point of Magnetiles. It's not to build something. It's to see what they do. Like, it's just to test them out. So giving her that permission to, like, not do what it says on the box and build the, like, castle, right? Like, they had only seen them as, like, a building tool. And because that's how society sees them. But I was like, you can just play with them, just like interact with them and see what they do. The point is to figure out what they do. And like this light went on and she just giving her permission to like not use them in a normative way. And she now plays with them all the time. So, and you know, connecting and making patterns and now building things, but like, not that the things on the picture, you know, like little kind of structures that, you know, become spaceships and things like that. So, yeah, it's really opened us up to like joy in a more visceral way.
Now, you're also a writer and a journalist, and your literary work has been published in a lot of different publications. So I'm wondering what advice you would give to aspiring writers in getting their works published.
There's a lot of really great advice out there and it's all right. Like it's all correct. Like you have to read to be a good writer. You have to, like, you know, and your early work is going to be an imitation, a poor imitation, you know, whether you're a musician or a writer or anything, like you start out as any type of artist imitating, you know, even the greats, like, you know, Michelangelo, Van Gogh, whatever, their early work resembled other people's work. And that's how we learn. So, you know, you can't be hard on yourself at the beginning. And you shouldn't be sending out work to publications in the beginning either. Like, you really need to have people read it and who you trust and be like, oh, this is actually really good. And I went a traditional route by going to a creative writing Master of Fine Arts program at a university. And that helped me along my way, but there's so many writers groups, like informal writers groups. Probably you could find them on Facebook or even at the library in your town. And that's the best way. Peers are really the best way to build your writing. And then, you know, there's literary journal lists out there and you should probably subscribe to one, you know, that you like, or read them at the library first. And that's how you climb climb the ladder. You start at like a publication that, you know, takes entry-level new voices. And once you collect a couple publication credits and your writing matures, you can aim for the higher tier. And then once you get at that tier, you go to that's just how it works. And it's, you know, it takes years, many, many, many years.
I read that you have an interest in something that we haven't talked a lot about here on Autism Stories. Which are modern utopias. What would be some examples of modern utopias and how did you become interested in these?
I have a thing that, like the thing I'm stuck on as a human and always have been, and like learning I'm autistic has really put this to the forefront, is that like I have always felt and still feel that like, everything designed in the world, like built environments, systems, like bureaucracies, you know, schools, institutions, everything, like the number one thing, the first thing that you have to plan for is joy to make it functional, even, right? So, and that's not even on the list. Like, you know, if you think of like all the schools, you know, public schools, and you go to these buildings and they're just like awful. Like they're just awful inside, you know, they're like concrete blocks and they smell like disinfectant sometimes. And There's not a lot of natural light, you know, the noise is so loud, the lights are so fluorescent, and it's just like nobody's happy in these spaces. No one. And you can't learn if you're not calm and relaxed. And it's like, or like public housing, right? Like, who would design an ugly building? Like, it doesn't cost a lot more to just, you have to make a building, right? Why are you designing ugly buildings that are objectively ugly? Like, it doesn't make sense. And no wonder people live in despair in buildings that look like despair incarnate, you know? So modern utopias for me is shorthand for, like, I don't like the single family housing living lifestyle. I'm in it, right? Like, I live alone with my family, but I'm such a people person. And so are two of my kids, that is just so isolating. Like, you have to make plans with people. And like, I'd love to be in a co-op, you know, where like, or like a dorm, like a family dorm, right? Where like, you know, you're in an apartment building, but it's supposed to be communal, you know, like you have communal giant living rooms and communal party spaces and communal play spaces. And yeah, you still have your like private space for your home. I need that private space and get away from people at the end of the day so that I don't have to listen to their chewing or whatever. You know, like, people can still annoy me, but as I've been writing a book about autism, and there's like a lot about joy-based design. And I think the design world has actually picked up on that more than society. Joy, or just human happiness or comfort or whatever, like, should be the first objective. And if you're designing a building or a system, like, you know, the DMV or something, and you know, it's so complicated, like, everyone's frustrated. Like, one, it's not accessible to people who have, you know, a different brain approach. If it's got like 14 steps, my ADHD is just like, nope, not going to do it. You know, like, I'll drive without a license. No, that's not true. But I do push it off still as much as possible, that sort of thing. So I think the city of Copenhagen in Denmark is like, as close as it gets to a real life modern utopia, in terms of like built environment. If you Google like really cool public spaces in Copenhagen, they've like got murals you can see from space almost. I mean, like, they've got like a building that you can ski down on fake grass with a park on top. It's just like their whole way of being. They have like an anarchy couple of blocks where like there aren't any laws except for like you can't murder somebody. You know, like, it's, you can do whatever you want as long as it's not like some heinous crime. I don't know. It seems like, and they invented Legos in Denmark. So I feel like there's got to be something about the Danes that understand that in an innate way that like the rest of us had to come at, you know, our own way, or like just don't get it yet. Cause there's joy, like there's just like incredible amounts of joy. I have not been to Copenhagen, but in researching like, what are the coolest public spaces? What are the coolest playgrounds? You know, like our playgrounds look all the same. They're cookie cutter, right? They're boring, and kids are just like, all right, like another climbing structure that looks the same as the other climbing structure. Like, okay, it swings. But like in Copenhagen, they're like, here's this giant dinosaur, climb it, you know? Or here's like a replica of a ship. Like, it's super fun, you know? And it's not like a wheel and a telescope, you know, but it's still a box basically like ours are. So yeah, that's a modern utopia. It's just like why can't you live with your friends and still be a family? It's asking like questions of like, what could like really be like, instead of like lonely and isolating, which clearly a lot of Americans are. This is a made up statistic, but I think like, you know, like a third of Americans don't have more than one or two friends or something. I feel like I've read that loneliness is an epidemic.
Yeah, definitely. There was just a great article in Time about loneliness and autism that people should definitely check out.
Yeah, I saw that headline. Yeah.
Heather, lastly, how can our listeners learn about you beyond this conversation?
I recently started a Facebook page for Fantastically Human. People can just go to fantasticallyhuman.com, just spelled like it is, or Google it. And like, there's a contact form too for like people who want to engage. I don't really charge anything for the autistic community. Like, that part is like, I want that just for my own life, for helping people navigate, especially like newly diagnosed adults, late in life diagnosed autistic people. Like, I think we all need to band together. And like you're doing, you know, like you're creating community. And so that practice isn't like, I'm really hoping to reform institutions, you know, like that's, and institutions, you know, can't afford it. But like, for us, I'm just like, let's just hang out. Let's talk. Tell me your stories. I'm writing a book. Like, you know, if anyone has stories about their autistic superpower, or, you know, something that's holding them back or whatever, like, I'd love to hear them and include them.
Well, Heather, thanks so much for the conversation. Very much enjoyed meeting you.
Yeah, me too. Thanks so much, Doug, for having me.
Thanks so much to Heather for the conversation. To learn more about Heather, please check out the link in the podcast description for this episode. We always love hearing from you and would especially love to hear from you relating to this episode on, if we lived in a utopian society, how do you feel autistic and neurodivergent people would be perceived differently compared to the world we live now? And how do you feel they would integrate into that ideal world? Here at Autism Personal Coach, our clients are the experts, our coaches are the guides. The majority of supports for autistics are not helpful. They try to fix us, not support us. That's why many are confused when we say our clients are the experts, experts of their lived experience. Our clients are the experts for what has worked for them and about the things they need and want in their lives. Our coaches first listen to our clients and then ask thoughtful questions, offer resources, and strategize with our clients so they can get what they need to thrive. Would you want a guide in your life to coach you to help you to get the things you desire? If so, then visit autismpersonalcoach.com for more information. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Autism Stories. And if you did, if you could tell a friend, foe, or anyone else you know about it, so they could have the same enjoyable and educational experience as you when listening to Autism Stories, it would be very much appreciated. Until next time, I'm Doug Bletcher of Autism Personal Coach. Talk to you then.